Your Honors, good morning. This is Gary Burcham. I represent petitioner Mr. Hosley. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. There is no dispute in this case that the prosecutor committed multiple incidents of misconduct during closing argument and rebuttal. She misstated the law, she used evidence for an improper purpose, and she improperly used prior conviction impeachment evidence. The question for the court this morning is whether the state court unreasonably found that all of these errors were harmless. I'd like to start with the misstatements of law. Mr. Hosley, petitioner, presented an imperfect defense of others' theory based on his claim that he actually believed two things at the time of the shooting. Number one, that his mother was in imminent danger of being killed or suffering great bodily injury. And number two, that this use of force was necessary to defend against this danger. The important point as to this defense is that under California law, neither of these beliefs had to be reasonable. They simply just had to be his genuine, actual beliefs. The prosecutor, however, argued in closing argument that for imperfect defense of another to lie, the beliefs had to be reasonable. She said it three separate times. Petitioner objected, but the trial courts overruled the objection and said that the prosecutor was correct, that the reasonableness requirement was in the instruction. The state court found that these misstatements of law were harmless because the trial court properly instructed on the law at the end of the case. It is true that at the end of the case, the trial court gave the jury proper instructions as to murder and manslaughter, but the state court's conclusion is unreasonable because, as this court's well-established case law sets forth, much more than simply instructing properly at the end of a case is required to cure misconduct. I cited this, some of the cases that stand for this: Simtob, Weatherspoon, Sanchez, and what all these cases say is that to appropriately and fully cure the harm from an improper prosecution argument, the trial court must take prompt and effective action to deal with it. And in this case, not only do we not have prompt or specific action from the trial court to address this improper statement of law on really one of the most important points at trial, the trial court actually made it worse by ratifying the improper statement of the prosecutor. I cited the Stein case, which says if at the end of a case there's a conflict in instructions, the jury cannot be presumed to follow the proper one. And because the trial court in this case did not do anything to correct the misconduct at the time that it occurred, and it actually made it worse by ratifying it, we have at the end of the case the jury hearing the proper instruction at the end of the case, but then essentially an instruction during the case that was directly contrary to that. This misconduct denied Mr. Hosley a fair trial because of its subject matter. But this case really boiled down to Mr. Hosley's state of mind. What did he actually believe was necessary at the time he was at the house, taking into account all of his mental health issues and all of the history he had with his mother? And based upon everything that was presented, including the testimony of Dr. Monroe, Mr. Hosley had a very strong argument that given his brutal and extraordinary background, he actually believed at that time that he needed to act in this way to save his mother. He had a much, much weaker argument that he had a reasonable belief based on all the facts that he needed to shoot Mr. Johnson. And that's why the misconduct as to this particular point is so prejudicial to Mr. Hosley. The second area of misconduct was the use of evidence for an improper purpose. Another key issue at trial was whether Mr. Hosley received a phone call on the way to his mother's house in which his mother told him that everything was fine. It was simply a gin night. They'd been drinking heavily. Witness Crowder testified that this call occurred. Petitioner said the call never occurred. And a couple other witnesses testified that they were not able to get a hold of Mr. Hosley on the way because his phone was off. The government argued in closing that the call did happen based on Crowder's testimony. The defense said the call never happened, saying the petitioner should be believed. In rebuttal, the government went outside the record in terms of evidence admitted for its truth and said that a letter that a petitioner's mother had written to Dr. Monroe supported Crowder's version that the call did happen and the jury should believe that the call happened. Just like the first issue, there was an immediate defense objection. The trial court, again, improperly overruled it and said to the jury, it's in response to the argument, go ahead. Again, the state court found that this argument was improper, but again, fell back to harmlessness, you know, no harm, no foul, because of the proper limiting instruction at the end of the trial. Again, I would point this court to the long line of cases, Simtob, Weatherspoon, Sanchez, Deck, that says you have to take prompt and effective action against this sort of misconduct to cure it. And if you don't, then it's deemed not cured and the jury is tainted by what the prosecutor said during the trial. As to prejudice, again, this was another really important point at trial, because if the jury believed that on the drive from San Leandro to Modesto, that Mr. Hosley's mother called him on the phone and said, hey, everything is okay, you know, we're just drinking, you know, that devastates his state of mind, voluntary manslaughter defense. So again, the second area of misconduct was as to a crucial point in this case. The third area of misconduct concerns the use of impeachment evidence for an impermissible purpose. The trial court admitted Mr. Hosley's 2000 PC 245 conviction, that was assault with a firearm, for impeachment only. And the trial court was very careful, very, very careful to sanitize it so it didn't unduly prejudice Mr. Hosley. And so it was only admitted for date, code section, and the fact that it was a felony. It notably, the government tried to introduce this prior conviction under the equivalent of federal rule 404B, and the district court, the trial court denied that, finding that was too prejudicial. The prosecutor brought the conviction out properly in cross, but then in rebuttal said that petitioner's prior conviction for shooting somebody in the past was not consistent with the doctrine of avoidance, and that related to the PTSD that his doctor had testified about. First of all, this was more information than the trial court allowed. The trial court sanitized this just to date, code section, and felony, and now the prosecutor is telling the jury that he was convicted for shooting somebody in the past. The 245 conviction for assault with a firearm does not require that you shoot someone, just simply that you assault and point the weapon at someone. And so we had the prosecutor adding information that was beyond the scope of what was admitted. And then we had essentially what sounds to me like a propensity argument. It sounds like, you know, he did it before, and so now he did it again. And so the state court declined to reverse, again, finding that the instructions at the end of trial cured this misconduct. The response to this one was better than the first two, but it was still late. It was at the very end of trial. And this is one of those errors where I think you have to wonder if you can actually unring this bell. I mean, this is a shooting of a man inside his house. We have the jury now learning of 8 years before the shooting, 11 years before the trial, another shooting by Mr. Hosley. And it never should have come in with all those facts, and it never should have come in for that purpose. And so,
Counsel, I have a question. I mean, you're right. The Court of Appeals found that all these things were error, but then found that they were all cured by the instructions that were given by the court. How can we find that conclusion is objectively unreasonable?
The reason the court
we have to apply here.
Sure. The reason why the court can find that is because the state court totally disregarded the line of case law that talks about what you actually have to do to cure the misconduct. The state court took sort of an if you instruct properly at the end, it cures everything before. And that's not at all how it works. I mean, there's a whole line of cases. Your Honor had the case from 2015, the Alcantara Castillo case. Where you talk about and the other panels talk about in Simtob and Weatherspoon and Sanchez, that you just can't instruct at the end and say everything is fine. You have to take prompt and effective action, including specifically noting what the misconduct was and telling the jury what it needed to do to handle the case properly. And so the reason why all of these conclusions are unreasonable is because the state court just adopted a blanket rule that if you instruct at the end and the instructions at the end are proper, everything that happened beforehand is fine, even if the trial court didn't take prompt and effective action. And even in two instances here, the trial court actually ratified what the prosecutor said, and in doing so, gave a de facto instruction to the jury at that time that was directly contrary to what the applicable law was. So that's the problem, and that's why these state court conclusions are unreasonable.
Counsel. Judge Gould, if I can interject.
Yes, sir.
In terms of the cases that you're relying on to say there has to be prompt and effective action as opposed to curing it at the end, or any of those Supreme Court precedents?
No, those were Ninth Circuit cases, essentially applying the Darden test, which is a clearly established law here. It's the Darden test that says a prosecutor's improper comments violate the Constitution if they so infect the trial with unfairness as to make the resulting conviction a denial of due process. And when we apply that test, and when the Ninth Circuit has applied the test in those cases that I've been talking about, they look to see whether it so infected the trial with unfairness. They look as to whether that happened, as to the curative instruction, and you know, was it prompt? Was it effective? And again, in this case, we don't have either. And in two of the three, we actually have ratification and the direct opposite of what the trial court should have done. I also bring a cumulative error argument in this case. You know, we always bring that in cases where there's multiple errors. I mean, this one, these errors are right. They really fit together in terms of how they affected and prejudiced unfairly Mr. Hosley. They went to his state of mind. They went directly to his defense. The jury at best at the end of the case was confused as to the applicable law and on these key trial issues. It was told to reject Mr. Hosley's defense based on evidence never admitted for that purpose. And at the very end of the trial, in the rebuttal, it was essentially left with a, you know, he did it before and he did it again sort of propensity argument that never should have been admitted in trial. And so I know we have a depth of deference in this case, and I need to clear that hurdle. But I think based upon the state court's complete failure to do any sort of reasonable curative analysis, I think we meet that standard in this case, and we're asking the court to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Hosley's petition. And I'll reserve my final 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right, thank you, counsel. Mr. Riley.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Justin Riley on behalf of the warden. I'd like to start by building on something Judge Gould touched on, and that is appellant's argument that the curative measures taken by the state court must have been prompt and specific or prompt and effective. That is a test gleaned from supervisorial Ninth Circuit authority applying Darden. And in Parker versus Matthews, the Supreme Court has chastised the Sixth Circuit for teasing out a test out of Darden where one didn't exist. Instead, the state court reasonably found that the trial court took remedial measures as to all of the prosecutor's misstatements, and it's uncontested that the trial court gave a complete, clear, correct statement of the law and how all evidence was to be used by the time the jury went into the jury room. And the jury took written copies of those correct instructions in with them as well. I'd like to touch briefly on what the petitioner's defense was. Petitioner's defense focused on anything less than first-degree murder. He wasn't really focused on unreasonable self-defense. That was just one of the many options he was trying to get at. And the reason we know this is because at page 70 of the excerpts of record, where the state court recounted a summary of the petitioner's testimony, petitioner himself testified that he never intended to shoot. He didn't even remember shooting. And it was basically an accident. The gun went off without his knowledge. That was his testimony. He didn't testify that he believed that he needed to shoot the victim because of some sort of altercation. He didn't even realize he pulled the trigger. In that context, the prosecutor's misstatements regarding unreasonable self-defense are that much less harmful. And when a prosecutor misstates the law and the trial court gives a correct instruction on the law, that is not a conflict of instructions. Those are not conflicting instructions in the meaning of the Supreme Court's declaration that conflicting instructions need to be cured in a certain way. The conflicting instructions that the Supreme Court was describing there were two instructions given by the trial court. So that doesn't fit either. I'd like to touch briefly on the harmless, the cumulative error argument. Remember that Chambers versus Mississippi and even this court in Parle has described cumulative error as accumulation of prejudice based on constitutional errors. So petitioner must prove more than one constitutional error and then somehow that the synergy between them accumulated to deprive him of a fair trial. I'd love to answer any questions. If there are none, I'm prepared to submit. I'm sorry, I don't have all the judges on my screen.
Does anybody have any questions?
No questions here from Judge Gould.
Thank you very much.
No questions.
All right, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Burcham?
Your Honor, just a couple of comments in response to the government's argument. With respect to what Mr. Hosley said about what happened, he said he just didn't remember what happened. And the doctor talked about his dissociative disorder, which can affect someone's ability to recall or comprehend things as they're happening. And he went in and said, look, I went there and we had the confrontation at the door. And I don't remember exactly what happened, but he never denied that he shot him. And he just simply said looking back, I don't know exactly what happened, but he never denied shooting Mr. Johnson. And that's why the voluntary manslaughter defense was very much alive in the case. With respect to the fact that I'm citing Ninth Circuit cases in favor of the requirements to adequately cure something. I mean, when the Supreme Court gives us a super broad test and says that it's a constitutional violation if the errors so infect the trial with unfairness as to make the resulting conviction a denial of due process, then the circuit courts try to figure out in each instance what has to happen for it to be a denial of due process, or what has to happen to maintain a person's right to due process. And so the circuit courts are simply applying that general standard, and in this case, doing it in the context of curing prosecutorial misconduct. And so these cases are exactly how it's supposed to work, in terms of taking a broad proposition from the Supreme Court and then applying it to particular instances. And so those are controlling as to this issue. They're exactly on point as to what the trial court needed to do in this case. And it failed miserably in terms of curing the error as to all three areas of misconduct. And, the government wants to say this case was about, second degree murder or voluntary manslaughter or imperfect self-defense. His best defense was the defense of another, the reasonable defense of another, voluntary manslaughter. And the misconduct and the trial court's failure to cure it properly had a tremendous, unduly prejudicial effect on Mr. Hosley. And it ended up, as Darden said, infecting the trial with unfairness to the extent that it denied him his right to a fundamentally fair trial under the due process clause. And that's what we're asking the court to find.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Hosley versus Hill will be submitted.